The Tom Woods Show, episode 544.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, it's Cyber Monday and you're going to have to act fast. But today, Bluehost is offering the lowest rates I've ever seen from them for web hosting. Just $2.95 a month. So if you've been meaning to start that blog, do it today through tomwoods.com/blue. And then Rocket Languages is taking 60% off the first 500 courses sold today. Check them out at tomwoods.com/rocket. Hello and welcome to another week of episodes. I am so glad to be talking to Tom Mullen today. And let me tell you something before I talk to Tom. What a tremendous weekend I had. Thanks to my wonderful friends in the Free State Project. I went to two different gatherings of Free Staters, one on Thanksgiving Day itself and one the following day. And then I spent some time in Massachusetts at my 25-year high school reunion, and it just couldn't have been better. And it's funny, you look back on your high school years and everybody knew that you belonged to a certain group and other people belonged to other groups, and the groups don't mix. You don't talk to those people. You have no interaction with them. But it's interesting that 25 years just melts that all away. Nobody cares anymore, and we all genuinely are happy about each other's successes. It really is great. And it was funny, I actually met somebody who is now doing marketing for Procter & Gamble. And so I talked about A-B split testing, and I love this stuff. You know, the stuff I try to bore some of you guys with, I love that stuff these days. Entrepreneurship and marketing fascinates me. So blah, 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 blah. What a great weekend. Anyway, enough of that sentimental stuff. It was great. I'm looking forward to spending some time in New England next summer, 2016. But anyway, let's talk to Tom Mullen, who is sort of an old hand here in the liberty movement. And he's got a new book out, which I think is very well executed, and it's called Where Do Conservatives and Liberals Come From? Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Give me the 60-second thesis of your book, and then we'll get into the details.
Well, what I set out to do in the book was really to examine not just what liberal and conservative politicians do and say, but how they think. What is the underlying philosophy? And I especially wanted to address the idea on both sides, but especially in the conservative movement, that if we could only get a true conservative or an authentic liberal who really represented those philosophies, that everything would be fine. And what I do is I compare the philosophers who everybody cites as the foundational writers and thinkers of both conservatism and liberalism, and compare them to what I call the American Creed, which is the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, inalienable rights, government instituted to secure them, etc., and see if they hold up. I mean, would a true conservative really execute the American Creed, or would a true liberal do so? And that's what the book is about.
Well, let's jump in. Let's do conservatives first, because they're a bit more of a challenge in a way, because they very ostentatiously associate themselves with the founding fathers. And I noticed that the order in which you take them on in the book is you do the conservatives first. It sort of reminds me, I don't mean to make this entirely self-referential, but when I did my last book last year, Real Dissent, I took the toughest part of all, the foreign policy part, and put it right at the beginning. So the people would, you know, people would be throwing it down in anger right away rather than waiting for them to throw it down in anger. So likewise, you start right out with the conservatives. Now, when I listen to conservative rhetoric on TV and when I read it in conservative magazines, it sure sounds to me like they simply want to get back to the Republic of the Founding Fathers. Is there something misleading about that?
Well, I think if you really do in 2015 have to cut through a little bit of rhetoric, because they definitely do lean on them and they say the word free market. But if you look at what they really want to do, I mean, what's the greatest example? We're not going to repeal Obamacare. We're going to repeal and replace it. And, you know, the question, why does it have to be replaced? Why can't we just start repealing if we really believe government interventions are what cause our problems? And, you know, what I get into in the book is that as you go back in time, I think conservatives were a lot more explicit that they don't really believe in what's in the Declaration of Independence. And they've, you know, they're the thinkers that even modern conservatives point to, like Russell Kirk, who harkens back to Edmund Burke, really don't have a lot of disagreements with what I call the modern founding father of conservatism, Thomas Hobbes. And the main reason that they don't is that they see human nature the same way all of them do, which is as fallen, kind of depraved because of, you know, the original sin or whatever they trace it back to, that without government force and left to his own inclinations, man will always make war against his fellow man. He'll never keep a contract. He will never respect the property or the liberty or the life of anybody else. And so the conservative believes you need force in every space to counteract this, to counteract man's natural inclinations. And as Thomas Hobbes often says, to keep us in awe so that we don't act the way that we otherwise would.
Now, there is an initial plausibility to what you're saying, given that there's so much emphasis among conservatives in the political arena on the military and the police. These are the sectors of society that are held up to us repeatedly as models, uniquely so. And it does seem to feed into what you're saying. It seems to be a symptom of what you're saying, that we're, you know, given what man is, we're always more or less on the verge of some kind of catastrophe, and he needs to be held in check, and his passions need to be held in check through the use of force. Now, that's not to say, by the way, that libertarians or the founding fathers didn't believe that human beings had passions that needed to be kept in check, but that doesn't necessarily mean the police are the people to do it.
Well, I what I call the libertarians in the book, which would be the people who agreed with Thomas Jefferson's preamble in the Declaration of Independence, they do see that without a government there, that there is danger. But the difference between what I would call a libertarian and a conservative is that the libertarian sees man in a more realistic way, in my opinion, which is he's capable of good and evil. And we see people without being forced to voluntarily doing all kinds of philanthropic things. We see them existing peacefully with their fellow people, you know, when they really don't have any downside to not doing so. But then we also see them stealing, murdering, lying, cheating, and everything else. So I think the libertarian view of man is actually the most realistic. He's capable of both. And if we're going to employ force, whether by a government or some private institution, it should only be in response to the bad side, to when he does aggress against somebody and commits some sort of real crime with a victim.
Also, in terms of being realistic, which side sounds like it's really being more realistic about the state and its nature and its likely behavior? I mean, the irony is this is the institution that's held up as the preserver of order, as the institution that will help to form man's soul and form his conscience and make him into a good citizen and restrain his wicked appetites and promote his virtues. But given the incentive structure that exists in the state is the very institution in which man's most undesirable qualities are the most magnified. So it's not a coincidence that it attracts people like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and George W. Bush and John McCain. These are its natural constituents.
Yeah, and I think you said an important word, which was promote. One thing the conservative believes that the libertarian does not, in my opinion, is that the government can promote anything. I mean, the best that the libertarian thinks the government can do is thwart evil when it's immediately presented to defend somebody, and even most or a lot of libertarians don't even believe it can do that very well. But the conservative believes there's a larger role for the government to promote virtue, as you said, which means that the government can require certain things of people. The American creed, as I call it, you know, doesn't include that. It only includes securing rights. So you can't require anybody to do anything. You can just prohibit certain actions. And what you can prohibit is very limited. I do think there's one other important point here, though, that you also made, and which I get into in the book, which is there are two kinds of conservatives. There's kind of two schools. And one of them are definitely the Hobbesians, or the centralizers, as I call them. And these are the John McCains. These are the George W. Bushes, the Abraham Lincolns, if you go back farther, who say that, look, all the power has got to be in one place, because even if you divide it, let's say between state and federal government or between branches of government, you have a problem. You have a chink in the armor. Here we go back to the cars turned over and burning in total chaos, right? And then there's the other school that says just what you said, that, wait a minute, these people in the government are just as fallen as everybody else. So we do need to divide that power up. And what I call the constitutionalists, more the followers of Edmund Burke, say, you know, some things should remain locally governed. But I think the important point is that whether you're a Burkean constitutionalist or a Hobbesian centralizer, all the power is delegated to the government somewhere. So as I say, if it's not going to be the federal government, it's going to be the state or the municipal or your local school board. Nothing is left to the individual. On the other side, Thomas Jefferson, John Locke, who was his inspiration, as I go through in the book, they have most power left with the individual, and only the power to thwart aggression against property as delegated to the state.
I would say I think you make a bit too strong of a distinction between conservatives and the founding fathers on some things. I think this is one of them. Jefferson believed in castration for sodomy, which is not a reflection of a pure idea of individual rights. A lot of early American thinkers, and including some founding fathers, believed in protective tariffs rather than a purely laissez-faire economy. And a whole lot of them believed in local self-government, which did mean the power of local governments sometimes to interfere with people's liberties. That sounds like a constitutional conservative to me.
Yeah, and I do get into people not being consistent in the book. And I think, to me, the idea of leaving any power, much less as much as Locke does, is very new. I can't find anybody before Locke to come up with this idea that the government would never have any more power over the citizens than one individual has over another in the absence of a government. So then do they apply it very well? Well, they apply it better, and libertarians have applied it better as time goes on. Libertarians in the 21st century apply those ideas much better than Thomas Jefferson or any of his Democratic Republicans. And a real good example, John Locke is, you know, also cited for religious tolerance. And he said that we should tolerate all religions, but he says you can't tolerate atheism because then the oaths in court wouldn't have any meaning. And Jefferson breaks from him there and says, no, that's nonsense. You know, you can tolerate atheism just as well as all the others. It doesn't pick my pocket or break my leg. So, I mean, as time goes on, I think the ideas get applied better. Were they consistent? By no means. And I think I mentioned in the book that in the summary view that Jefferson wrote, he's very conservative, very much like a Burkean conservative, that these liberties and rights are prescriptive. In other words, we've had them over time. They're established. You can't come in here and change things. So, that's kind of my answer to that. I think that you have to always be separating in any one individual. Are they thinking like a conservative, or are they thinking like what I would call a libertarian or a liberal?
I thought it was interesting that you even went to the extreme, and I don't mean extreme in a negative way, of saying that conservatives don't necessarily believe in the free market to the extent that you might think they do. And on this, of course, we can think back to some 19th century conservatives whose view was that the free market is going to undo all kinds of social relationships that have existed. When the only thing linking us is the almighty dollar, this will dissolve all other types of relationships. And there were all these fears. And this was the sort of thing that Karl Marx even talked about. But as usual, Marx was wrong. I think this was a dumb fear. I think these conservatives were totally their analysis was completely off, but there definitely were the Ruskins of the world and others who were fearful that the market was going to upset the established order. Now, having said that, when I listen to Ted Cruz talk about the economy, he sounds pretty laissez-faire to me. Relatively speaking, he sounds pretty laissez-faire. So that's one point that you would have to answer. On the other hand, the Trump phenomenon does seem to line up very well with what you're saying, because Trump is more or less non-ideological. Like, he does think that taxes should be cut, but not he's not dogmatic about it. He does think that the government is broken, which is a, typical sort of conservative thing to say. He does think that maybe businesses shouldn't have so many regulations on them, but he's not going to take that to any dogmatic extreme. He's more or less going to go on his instincts. He's a smart guy, and he's going to implement what seems to be necessary, and that's going to include tariffs and all these other interventions. And the Republican base is absolutely eating it up, even though it runs contrary to the ideas they've been telling us they believe for 20 years.
Yeah, and I think that this is something I'm going to get into part two of the book. I released part one because it wasn't getting better with age, and this book has been mostly written for 3 or 4 years. In this book, part one ends at the end of the 19th century, saying, things are going to change in the 20th. And I think the way I see things happening in history is that after the Democratic Party kind of got rid of classical liberalism and became the progressive liberal party that it is today, those classical liberal ideas had to reside somewhere. And I see that the more modern Republican Party is this jumble of classic conservatism, which I would associate with Lincoln. Lincoln's a great Hobbesian. He not only believes that there should be interventions, that there should be subsidies to corporations, high tariffs, protectionism, but he also believes all the power has got to be in one place, and he says so. And he says, like Burke and like Hobbes, that once the social contract is established, it can never be changed. That's the direct refutation of the Declaration of Independence. So if you follow, I would say, the real true conservatives through American history, you're going to go from Hamilton to Henry Clay to Lincoln to, the early Teddy Roosevelt has the progressive influence there, but really a big government conservative. And then, what happens to the Grover Clevelands and the more free market, laissez-faire people? They kind of migrate and find the only place in the 20th century that even talks about private property being a good thing, and that's the Republican Party. So you've got, and I think that's where you get this huge, it's always a battleground with the Republicans. It rarely is as much with the Democrats. They're very much all singing the same song, which is, we need to, undo the economic inequality that occurs because of private property.
Now I want to talk about where liberals come from. And of course, we're talking about left liberals, not classical liberals. So now we'll have even more fun. But before we do that, let's just pause for this message. Friends, today is the day to pull the trigger if you've been meaning to start that blog, because you're not going to see lower prices on web hosting from Bluehost ever. And they're doing it only today, Cyber Monday 2015, $2.95 a month. Check it out through tomwoods.com/blue, and I'll send you a bunch of free bonuses. I'll send you 24 free tutorials showing you how to get good at WordPress. At tomwoods.com/demo, you can find my free 5-minute tutorial taking you through the process of signing up and showing you how easy it is. And then I'll also give your blog some publicity. Just write to me at tomwoods.com, and I'll give you a little free publicity. And those of you who have written to me recently, I will get to you, but with Black Friday going on, your publicity was going to get lost in the shuffle, and I didn't want to do that to you. So again, today is the day. tomwoods.com/blue, and you'll get the best rate you're ever going to see. All right, Tom. Now, much as I like critiquing conservatism or what it's become or some of its initial errors, I have some sympathy for conservatism all the same. I have no sympathy for leftism whatsoever. I guess that's probably become obvious to listeners of the show. I just have no sympathy for it at all. So for me, this is the more fun part. Even though, I mean, I feel like critiquing the conservatives is like a dreary necessity. But for some reason, I can critique the left with gusto. And that's just the way I was raised. It's the influences I had when I was a kid. And there ain't no change in me now. I'm in my 40s and I'm set in my ways. So let's talk about where liberals come from. And here you talk about Rousseau, which I think is so great and so important because his imprint is all over these people.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just picked up a couple of his two treatises that I talk about in the book, you just can't help but hear Hillary Clinton, hear Barack Obama, hear every Democrat you could remember over the last century, Woodrow Wilson especially, which I get into in part two of the book. But Rousseau's premise is it's so interesting, the striking contrast. So what does he see as man's nature? He doesn't see him as an angel as opposed to Hobbes's devil, but he sees him as kind of this blissfully ignorant Adam before the apple kind of thing. He's wandering through nature, picking berries and, you know, as you always say, sunshine and rainbows, right? Barely aware of his fellow man, no division of labor. And he's in the Garden of Eden. And what is it that takes him out of this? It's not eating the apple. It's not original sin. It's when he first gets the idea to acquire private property. When he says, this is mine, and he finds suckers to believe it. I think there are so many words Rousseau says. Then after that, there's all the conflicts start. And the government's job for Rousseau is to undo these not only do the conflicts start, but the main defect of the state of nature, the advanced state after private property, which is gross inequalities all over the place. That is the result of having private property, and it's the government's job to make people equal again, or as equal as they can be made, at least for Rousseau's purposes, and have some kind of what he would call justice, which has to do with equality rather than equal rights.
He also has quite a bit to say about education. And what would you say is the most fundamental principle in terms of education that comes from Rousseau that might shock us today?
Well, I mean, he comes right out and says that education, the purpose of education is not reading, writing, and arithmetic. Its primary purpose is to what we would now call brainwash or indoctrinate people into loving the government. He doesn't use the word big brother, but you might as well when you read the passages about what he says the education should do. Of course, the government has to control education and make sure that only things that would make people obedient to it and obedient to what he calls the general will, something we would argue doesn't exist. In some respects, you know, all the actors in my book, the real people, share this. Even Jefferson, and this is a very unlibertarian thing, he wanted to indoctrinate people as libertarians. He actually had a resolution passed at the University of Virginia to say, this is the ideas that we are going to inculcate in people. So, you know, that's one thing that human nature seems to not be able to resist. But back to Rousseau, yes, obedience to the government and conformity is definitely the goal of education for the liberal.
How do we see the influence of Rousseau in the typical leftist we might encounter?
Well, there's two things. I mean, obviously, what's the number one issue on the Democratic platform this year? Income inequality. And this is the primary defect of nature that government is supposed to solve for Rousseau. He's not a communist. He doesn't say that we're going to confiscate everybody's property. He says we're going to regulate it and we're going to make sure that no one gets too rich. A lot, you know, there's shades of Plato, although Plato does go communist in some passages. But very much there's going to be an unlimited democracy, and how much property everyone's going to be able to keep or acquire in the first place is going to be heavily determined by majority vote. So the big difference there is there's no limit on what the majority can do in Rousseau's vision, where with Locke and the libertarians, you know, there's huge limit on what can be voted on. And, you know, it doesn't just extend just to economics. Economics are dominant, but it's equality in everything. So what do we see that the Democratic Party is advocating everywhere? They want everybody to have an equal experience, and it's gotten so outlandish that even men and women are supposed to experience the world exactly the same. And this all stems from this idea that the chief political end is this unqualified equality of all people.
What I took away from reading this book is it's something I'm not sure you realized as you were writing it. Maybe you did. No, you probably did, but I realized it much, much more sharply after reading it, which is that it's just wrong. It's wrong on every level to say that libertarians borrow some from the left and some from the right, and that's where their ideology comes from. And that is unfortunately the way it is portrayed, even by heads of major libertarian think tanks. They say, well, we're fiscally conservative and socially liberal. Like, we don't really have a philosophy. We just take things that we think you guys will like. That is exactly the opposite of the truth. We have a very systematic philosophy that is extremely principled, and it doesn't owe anything to either of these positions. What do you say about that?
No, I absolutely agree. And that's the inspiration for the book. And especially with the conservatives, we tend to get lumped in with the conservatives. But no, I mean, the American Revolution, as I see it, was a war between libertarians and conservatives. And much of the 19th century was the same in American politics. It's not till the 20th that you get the philosophy we now call liberalism coming in. It was a battle very much between the libertarians and the conservatives. Unfortunately, the conservatives won a resounding victory. And then here comes the liberals as a reaction. And today, that founding libertarian principle of the individual retaining most of his authority and all of his rights is just completely gone.
Well, the book is Where Do Conservatives and Liberals Come From? Of course, I will link to it on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/544. I'll also link to your website, Tom, tommullen.net. Anything else I should be linking to on that page?
No, that sounds great, Tom, and I appreciate it very much.
It's been a pleasure chatting, Tom. We'll have you back soon. When's the next book coming out?
I've got it targeted for sometime in the spring. It's about part two is about half written right now. So, should be just as controversial and startling with some of the things that come out in the 20th century.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. We'll definitely have you back to talk about it. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, check out Tom's book at tomwoods.com/544. Before we wrap up for today, two things I want to tell you. One's a reminder. My big debate with Michael Malas in New York City is coming up this Thursday, and I'm going to keep you posted as to who won. Because he and I are debating the legacy of Alexander Hamilton. This Thursday night, December 3rd, 2015, Dave Smith, the comic we all loved, who was a guest on this show some episodes ago, is going to be opening with some comedy material, so that's going to be great. But the event is taking place, where did I put that? I just had it on the computer. Yeah, okay, here it is. It's going to be at the General Society Library, 20 West 44th Street in New York. And you want to start getting there around 7 p.m. We're going to socialize for a while. The venue holds only 200 people, and I think this is going to have a pretty good turnout, so you'll want to get there to get a seat. And then as that first hour goes on, we'll start to get announcements. Dave Smith will go on. And then at 8 o'clock sharp, Michael and I will start the debate. And it's an Oxford-style debate, which means they're going to poll the audience beforehand and see if you agree or disagree with the resolution. Then after hearing Malas and me speak, then they poll the audience a second time. And whichever one of us has changed more minds, whichever direction the minds have been changed in, on balance, is declared the winner. Now, I won't be able to tell you the next day, Friday, December 4th, if I was the winner or not, because I will already have recorded an episode to cover me while I'm flying back home. So you won't know until Monday, unless you subscribe to my newsletter. I will be telling those people the same night. I'll send out a note to let you know what exactly happened, to tell you how the cleanup crew is doing, because, of course, there'll be pieces of Michael Malas all over New York City by the time I'm done with them. So if you'd like to know immediately what happened, then sign up for my newsletter at tomwoods.com. Click on that red notify me button and you'll get the newsletter. Plus you'll get a free ebook. So, you know, why not do it? So my newsletter people will know what's going on, but the people who only listen to the podcast won't know till Monday. But it's going to be great fun. If you can possibly make it, please do try to do so. The other thing is today's Cyber Monday, and there's still great deals going on at libertyclassroom.com that will be ending at midnight tonight. And those are deals on our different membership levels, and there's a crazy deal on the so-called master member level, which is lifetime access to the site, plus all my Ron Paul curriculum courses. And we're taking $300 off that. It's totally insane. So check that out, libertyclassroom.com. Tomorrow, I can't remember what it is that we're doing, but I can't imagine it could be bad, right? I think we've got a pretty good, batting average for this show. So whatever it is, it's going to be great. Thanks for listening to this episode, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.